Welcome everybody to this insight session. I'm glad to see we have so many actuaries interested in defined benefit funds here. We're sort of bursting at the seams. We've got a similar number in Melbourne as well. So I guess as you're all aware, that following on from the Cooper review, the government in framing its stronger super package decided that APRA would have prudential standards making power in relation to superannuation funds. Last September, APRA issued a wide-ranging discussion paper covering its proposed approach to preparing those prudential standards in response to stronger super. So today we're going to focus on the elements of those prudential standards that affect defined benefit funds. Hence the title for today's session, the new DB funding framework. The wide-ranging paper that came out, of course, from, or discussion paper that came out from APRA last September was matched by a wide-ranging response from the Institute of some 27 pages put together by the Super Practice Committee and the Legislative Subcommittee of the Super Practice Committee. And today, Mike, who was on the Legislative Subcommittee and was responsible for drafting a large part of the defined benefit sort of aspects of the Institute response, is here today to lead us through a discussion on the prudential standards, what was in the prudential standards, what was in the Institute's response, some areas that still need to be addressed. APRA, we understand, is aiming to have its position out by the end of April, so we still, of course, don't know what will be in there and how much of our submission was taken up by APRA. So Mike is just about to take us through a discussion. He's happy to answer questions as we go through or at the end. As is customary, this is being recorded, so if you do have a question, I need you to speak into a mic, and there'll be two of them floating about the meeting. So with that, Mike.
Thanks very much, Brad. As Brad said, I'm happy to take questions on the way through, because there's only about 8 or 9 slides and they're basically dot points on various issues, and the purpose of these sessions is very much to get feedback from practitioners on what other things are of interest or of importance to members. It's no doubt a long exercise in terms of where we're going to get to, but it's all been constituted into a very short space of time in terms of what APRA's legislative deadlines are to get things done. So it's in that context that, you know, I'm happy to take, rather than go through and then come back, it's probably better to get input on the various sections, and I've split it up into various sections of what was happening. As Brad said, that as far as the background of this, obviously, is the Cooper Review and the Stronger Super legislation, and then APRA have got standard making powers. In particular, they're going to have the ability to have prudential standard in respect of funding, and they've announced that's in respect of vested benefits, rather than where the SG legislation at present focuses on technical insolvency for being able to satisfy minimum requisite benefits. And that's where most of the legislation around minimum funding is currently at present. But under this prudential standard issued by APRA, then it'll cover more than just minimum requisite benefits, and in particular focusing on targeting 100% minimum coverage of vested benefits to protect members' benefits at any time. One of the other things in the standards discussion paper from APRA was that defined benefit funds that were currently self-insured would be allowed to continue. As Brad said, that paper came out in September. It had, I think, 79 pages or something. The Actuaries Institute response in December was some 27 pages, of which only about 4 or 5 pages were on the defined benefit funding piece. But it's those aspects in particular that I'm going to go through. But at the end of the last slide includes a couple of other issues which aren't necessarily on defined benefit funding, where the practice committee is very keen to get members' views. So for as far as the Actuaries Institute submission is concerned, this is in relation to what the requirements will be if vested benefits aren't in fact funded to 100%, known as an unsatisfactory financial position, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. there isn't actually anything in our submission specifically about notifications to trustee and APRA of this circumstance, but it is just expected that the current requirements will continue in that respect. There will be a need for some sort of remediation plan within constraints, and our submission identified that perhaps targeting a maximum of 4 years, if a three-year target funding period was desirable, that 4 years in practice allowed for the period of time of identifying an issue, having analysis done, having discussions with trustee and employer before identifying things. That's the purpose of the 4 years in our submission. And again, it was 4 years if 3 years was seen to be the appropriate funding period, with a reference to, well, it could be 3 years, could be 5 years. As you'd most of you be aware, that at present the technical insolvency minimum restoration period is 5 years under the SG Act and regulations. But also, our submission identifies very much that it's important for APRA to have the ability to have discretion for longer than specified funding periods, so that individual fund circumstances could be taken into account. Our submission also identified that further adverse experience may occur. So if we're partway through a 3 or 4 year funding program, and I guess a specific example was even in the paper, which was we had the global financial crisis in 2008-ish, and then more negative downturns in 2010, and so funds which were on a restoration program then went a few steps backwards. Again, part of our submission is that effectively the deterioration subsequent to the initial problem being identified needs to be identified as arguably a separate event, and the clock potentially starts again, at least in respect of the further deterioration amount. We also identified that the maximum should be not a default position where people are aiming to go towards, that shorter periods would be encouraged from where both, you know, the trustees, the employers and the actuaries could see that. And so certainly just going for the maximum period is not what the actuaries think. Actuaries Institute's position is what definement of funds should be looking for at present. And it certainly should be, there's potential that what is going to be the monitoring and control process under the new environment, there are quite specific regulations around those issues when it's in technical insolvency, and it would be could cause considerable difficulty, I think, if all of those similar provisions flowed through to minor cases of unsatisfactory financial position. So there's a lot of practical issues around that which are going to need to be dealt with, I think. And the other point was, it could well be the case in certain funds, and government-backed ones was one example, but not necessarily the only one, where an ongoing position of less than 100% of vested benefits may well be actually acceptable, and that would need to be allowed for in the process. So the requirements for control during the period when you discover you're in an unsatisfactory financial position is one of the areas where we're keen to get feedback from members. It's clear that there'll be a need for a regular monitoring of experience and the ongoing suitability of whatever top-up contribution program is being required, but it's important that in practice we're able to recognise the limitations of data, the need to avoid requiring frequent new formal valuation reports. The issue around funding of benefit payments, where in the current position where you have a special funding insolvency certificate in relation to technical insolvency, one of the requirements is the actuary to have an approval process effectively for any payments out of the fund, which includes benefit payments and any other expenses in practical terms. So the issues that occur in that area are potentially relevant if the new principles regarding funding of vested benefits is going to be sort of consistent with that, and it's going to identify some significant issues for practicing actuaries to identify how that's going to work out in practice. A On the benefit payment side in particular, it's quite possible that the normal top-up payment of additional contributions that are being paid may be sufficient to cover the benefit payments that are being paid out in each quarter or each period, but it's an important part of the monitoring program, which we see as very specific for individual funds, because there are a number of small funds where basically the actuary may need to review each benefit payment, whereas in many funds it could be a case of relatively large amounts of payments within a quarter not being a trigger mechanism for any sort of actuarial review. In our submission, we argued that there shouldn't be any additional rules if it was to do with technical insolvency. But one of the tenets of our submission was, in fact, that the new control mechanisms and reporting around the funding of vested benefits should, in fact, replace the existing requirements around technical insolvency rather than just be in addition to them. So part of our submission effectively, if you like, almost worked on the theory that that could be the case, and we haven't got into a huge amount of technical detail if that's not the case. As Brad indicated, it's expected that these prudential standards will be issued by the end of April, and we're all cognizant, I think, of the difficult timeframe of APRA's agenda on various things that they need to achieve, and potentially some variations around what's currently built into Super Guarantee Act and regulations that might be inconvenient. I think we see there's potential practical issues that are going to arise in terms of whether or not the new system is going to be able to sort of replace that in part or potentially be in addition to, and all the difficulties that might be going to give for funds and employers potentially at present, where theoretically we're looking at minimum requisite benefits, we're looking at vested benefits, and then we're looking at the long-term accrued funding for the standard defined benefits under the plan. The main actuarial reporting for the vast majority of funds, the technical insolvency is not an issue, and it's really about the long-term funding and a little bit of and some analysis that the vested benefits in the relatively short term are reasonably under control. We anticipate that in the new world, a lot more control around the vested benefits is potentially going to take some of the heat out, or some of the emphasis, I suppose, out of the longer term funding. And another thing which is coming is the new accounting standards, where the AS25 accrued liabilities at present are in practical terms measured discounting at the expected fund earning rate, and the potential new requirements relate to that measure being based on a government bond rate, which will have a significant impact in terms of the reported amounts of accrued benefit liabilities. And again, another issue that actuaries and employers and trustees are going to need to deal with in their funding discussions. Perhaps now is as good a time as any to invite a little bit of input from the audience. Rather than just listen to me, but Brad's got one of the microphones. I'm guessing the other one is somewhere out in the audience, is it? And so, does anybody have any questions or comments that on that part at all? Okay, I'll continue on a little bit then. In terms of funding and solvency certificates themselves, and this is one area where the committee is really keen to get input back from members in terms of some of the issues that they're having currently around funding and solvency certificates, and thinking forward to what the implication might be when we're dealing with something which presumably will have a different name, but which will be relating in some way to funding and solvency related to vested benefits. So again, in our submission, should funding and solvency certificates be the item effectively, and should they change from focusing on minimum requisite benefits and up to vested benefits? And then if that's the case, can we get rid of some of the clunky requirements effectively that are sitting in FSCs at present around things like timing issues, lapsing on notifiable events, if the employer contributions are very inadvertently underpaid or slightly late, and whether things can be replaced at the end of the term or not. on the timing issues in particular, the effective dates of funding and sales certificates, when they start, when they cease, when they have to be replaced, when does a notifiable event actually occur? Is the maximum of 5 years on a funding insolvency certificate, which is currently the case, appropriate? Should that be shorter? Should it be longer, in your view? Could it only lapse, perhaps, in a notifiable event circumstance, lapsing only after a notifiable event if the actuary does not advise that it is still valid? Now, I know in practice actuaries have, in some respects, been drafting their notifiable events around issues to do with, let's say, poor investment return, high salary increases, and in the first hit, I guess, the thought was, oh, well, if the salary increases are too high, that's a notifiable event. I think second round actuaries looked at if the salary increases, if the actuary says after considering salary increases too high, then and the actuary thinks not, then it's a notifiable event. And the actuaries, I think, in practice have been dealing with notifiable event wordings to try and make the situation more practical in how funding and solvency certificates can operate in practice without requiring ridiculous amounts of replacement for very minor and things which are not in any way really affecting the practical funding or solvency of the plan. So the issue for the profession is going to be, when we go forward with the new professional standards, what the requirements are going to be around those. And as I say, the Institute is keen to hear some issues around the practical requirements on here that, that the Institute then should be taking up in discussion with the authorities going forward. As I said earlier, the timing of the new professional, the new standards coming out in the near future, and then the implementation period of when they're required to be implemented, which effectively is in 2013, does mean that a number of the practical issues probably won't be able to be dealt with as soon as we would like, but the Institute is very keen to ensure that we have a bank of these, and actually there's a whole pile of policy discussions that the Institute is continually in with both APRA or Treasury or the Tax Office, and they're keen to have those sort of issues on our plate so that we can deal with what members are finding difficult in practice. Again, that was one area where we are keen for some feedback. Does anybody want to ask a question or make a comment in terms of some difficulties around the current funding insolvency regime in particular? Well, the good news is we're going to have quite a quick session and you can all get back to work faster. Because, yeah, seriously, we thought that there would be quite a bit of discussion and so, you know, the presentation is not that long as such.
Well, let's try and get some discussion going. I mean, it is quite a change to suggest really that we get rid of the MRB regime and move to a vested benefits regime as being really our minimum test. So it's raising the bar on what is likely to, I guess, get APRA's keen interest in your funds if they get into some difficulties. So our approach to date has been to think, well, that's really a good idea. For many funds, MRBs are either forgotten or something that may get tested or sometimes something that may not even be programmed in people's designs because they're assumed to be always met by the vested benefits. So in some cases, it's... they don't really mean that much. In some cases, they might mean a lot, but universally just deciding to try and get away from them and just move to vested benefits seems like a sensible idea, but does anybody have, I guess, a concern with that or a contrary view? I think that's moving too far. Or did the committee capture 100% of people's actuaries' views on this matter so succinctly? Angie.
Yes.
Well, I guess perhaps increasingly MLBs are getting closer to vested benefits, if not being vested benefits, and over the next sort of 6 years, moving from 9 to 12 makes it even more the case. So to some extent they're coming closer together anyway. But yes, it does make it the potentially, I don't know how many employees that you have that are really adverse to putting money into their funds. I mean, we have a couple, so this is actually a bit of a change for one client I can think of in particular. Not my clients, so I don't have to deal with their intransigence and they're putting money in. But they won't necessarily like this. But our view is that, I guess, for the greater approach and having a more common approach across everybody, that is something that I just have to address. And what's our charter, Angie? You're just thinking that's a bad thing or a good thing? Mike, was there any sort of debate amongst the committee about moving to this position, or was it fairly universal?
I think the committee's position was it had been announced by APRA that they would be, and so arguing against it wasn't part of the brief, effectively. It was felt that...
Well, I guess
so there's that aspect of it, and then I guess there's the other aspect, which is that in practical terms, APRA's monitoring of funds at present has been seen that they are monitoring the vested benefit indices of funds and asking for regular and even quarterly feedback from either fund trustees, particularly of master trusts, of the various defined benefit plans under their trusteeship. So I think APRA has been monitoring vested benefits and talking to trustees and actuaries about vested benefit monitoring for, 4 or 5 years now. The committee felt, I think, that this was more formalising, putting into some standards what is actually happening in practice anyway, rather than something that was not happening at present and was a huge leap from where we are at present. So you mentioned a client who perhaps can't see a reason to fund more than minimum requisite benefits, but they presumably wouldn't be having discussions already. If their vested benefits are significantly higher than that, one would imagine that they're having issues with APRA and discussions.
Constantly a program in place. But I guess the other, relief valve in that equation, if it's vested benefits, is how long you have to rectify the situation.
That's right.
And so that's where there wasn't any period, I think, in the draft prudential standards.
There's certainly no period mentioned in the standards. Yeah. As I say, our submission said, a period of perhaps 3 or 4, 5 years, and then, starting from the position that in the legislation, as far as MRBs are concerned, 5 years is the statutory period by which they have to have an actuarially controlled program for bringing it back to solvency. The difficulty, I think, that some part of the committee's views was the fact that the actuaries had some problems with their employer and trustee clients, but the fact that the five-year provision on MRBs was the only thing that was statutory to actually encourage and work with clients on something shorter than that in respect of vested benefit shortfalls, which is certainly the position that the APRA discussions have typically taken, that if there was some regulatory control which related to a five-year period or even less in the new standards, then that would actually assist in some way some of the discussions with some clients in terms of identifying that, yes, it's in theory, in the past, there were some practical rules anyway, because APRA was very keen to discuss if you weren't following a program somewhat shorter than 5 years, typically. But if there is some legislative teeth about having to have a program around that, that could actually assist actuaries in their discussions and trustees in their discussions with employers. It is important to note that certainly one part of the submission was that what's the What's the outcome if you found to be unsatisfactory and not prepared to follow a an agreed program or the like that APRA finds acceptable effectively? And the trustee's duty to act in the best interests of members is very much mentioned in the paper, in our submission, sorry. And is it in the best interests of members to terminate their defined benefit fund because the financing of it isn't as good as APRA might like? Is an issue which was in our submission, and it's something that APRA and, depending what comes out of the standards, trustees in future are going to potentially have to deal with in certain circumstances. If the only outcome is effectively termination of accrual of future defined benefits and then possibly loss of value of past accrued defined benefits, there's a serious discussion point about whether that's in the best interest of those members concerned.
Question on this is, was there any debate on what impact the financial strength of employers would have, or how relaxable perhaps otherwise one might be about the time available to correct spending deficits?
It was certainly some discussion at the committee level. One of the later aspects, which I will come onto, is the use of surplus provisions, which has the same criteria. And there was basically a couple of sentences in our submission which referred to potential employer covenants or assets outside the fund being available, as is the case in the UK, as an example. There's certain covenants and methods of having guaranteed assets which aren't in the fund, and part of our submission certainly is that the repatriation of surplus provisions are not helpful to employers in wanting to put to be sure. And I think the majority of our defined benefit clients, I think, would be more than happy to fund vested benefits at 100% plus level with even some margin if they could be reasonably assured that they could get out of the fund with out the current provisions in SIS where the trustee actually has to make a decision that the withdrawal of surplus is in the interests of members, and in practical terms that has almost always come attached to significant benefit improvements for members in that process. Within the submission there are sections on the current repatriation of surplus rules and the negative support that that has on employers in terms of wanting to go along with voluntary levels of funding that are in excess of what might be required. And certainly it is the case with sort of many designs, particularly where the leaving service benefits are in fact defined benefit related, that they might be a relatively lowly or undiscounted accrued retirement benefit available from age 50 or 55, where to have that covered in vested benefits terms at age 50 and 55 will inevitably result in surplus, all other things being equal, if that person stays through and retires at 65. And many of us are now dealing with lots of funds where you're getting down to relatively small numbers of members, and it's starting to be individually handling almost about what's specific for which fund and what their design is like in terms of whether there's cliff benefits where resignation benefits all of a sudden become early retirement benefits, or, as I said, the other example where non-discounted early retirement benefits are hard to cover in a vested benefit situation, but you're funding towards accrued liabilities with reasonable early retirement decrements to age 65 will show that you've got a funded situation as far as accrued liabilities are concerned, but not necessarily as far as vested benefits are concerned. So there's lots of incidences in individual funds where it causes issues, and that's one of the reasons in our submission is that it is very important for APRA to reserve for itself some flexibility in dealing with this and being able to actually tailor it for individual fund circumstances.
Very good.
isn't that certification based on reasonable the assumptions about continued payment of employer contributions and the interest or investment return and salary increase assumptions that you're using in making that certification? Yeah. We agree that there's a lot of volatility, and I guess that's where APRA is coming from, is that sort of certification, when you then have poor investment returns, it triggers an unsatisfactory position, and they want
the
yeah, and they're keen to, to ensure that the employers, trustees and actuaries are on top of the situation sooner rather than later and have some plan in mind as to how to address it. And as Brad mentioned, a client example, but there's many other client examples where this is a short-term situation where over various periods of the last decade or two, there's been lots of positive bits where the actuary has taken a long-term view and that is short-term negative investment performance any different than short-term positive investment performance in terms of how it should be being handled in a long-term situation. It's in those environments where the employer covenant issue becomes relevant, and for a private sector employer, we are all unfortunately live in the world where the employer covenant might not be all that valuable, even for an apparently very well funded and backed employer. They're the issues that APRA are clearly trying to deal with, because it's not in anybody's interests if funds are wound up with members getting less than their vested benefits in the process.
But if it does end up with vested benefits, it becomes a better margin
Again, on the return of surplus issue, the Institute's submission specifically identified that if total service liabilities were covered by more than something, it should be effectively immediately available to the employer. And I think they're allowing for a margin of 10% or more, I think. But accrued liabilities, again, and allowing for some sort of withdrawal. The committee is still doing ongoing work in terms of research of what's actually happening in terms of financing and funding things in other countries to equally apply that. It's fair to say that what we see in other countries, just because of our lump sum situation, the focus on vested benefits and portability or whatever that we have in this country makes it quite difficult to translate some of the more longer term and funding issue sort of options that are available in other countries. Nadine, is there a microphone to pass across? More often than you'd think, Nathan, in the sad world of employer contributions to superannuation funds and admin systems and whatever, there's a requirement within the funding solvency certificate to specify a payment time, and that could be annually in arrears. To the extent that you do specify something, then a day late from something automatically breaches something. So the whole contribution has turned up, but it's turned up one day late. It's a month after it turned up before you find out that it was late. But the requirement is, if funding solvency is lapsed, the actuary's got to go do a new one, is the formality on it. And similarly, that yes, they were supposed to pay 12% of salaries or 12% of ordinary time earnings, but they've missed this bonus for this person. So again, they've gone or something on that. So I think it is a reasonably regular occurrence that inadvertent non-compliance with a contribution payment schedule does actually occur. That's sort of a view that I've seen from time to time. I'm interested to see whether the others in the audience would agree with that statement or not. I'm seeing you.
A couple of things. Certainly, from a practical viewpoint, I've seen cases where APRA has taken proper account of the particular circumstances of a fund and an employer, and in particular where DB is a small part now of the total super liability of that company. The company itself is very strong, and also the other bugbear of having an old-fashioned trustee that doesn't allow any repatriation of surplus to the employer in any circumstances, and where the accumulation has been moved to a separate fund for whatever purpose, that overfunding is a real issue, because you've got this diminishing number of DB members, and in those circumstances APRA has been quite sympathetic and been prepared to agree to what appears to be a sensible funding to meet the particular circumstances. Certainly we do have to look at the trustees as well as, because if you had this ability to repatriate surplus over and above the 110, well, that would be good, but you'd need the ability to override the particular trustee. And I agree with what you said before, that people are treating this as ho-hum to some degree because of the minimum requisite benefits and the vested benefits becoming much closer together, and that trend's going to continue.
In the example, Jeff, APRA had, so it's a good example of where we would like APRA to have discretion, and where in that circumstance it appears that it has been used in a reasonable fashion, at least satisfactory fashion from that employer or trustee's perspective. Was that a discussion in respect of vested benefits or MRBs, and do you think the situation could change if APRA had some teeth around vested benefits, whereas they only have teeth around MRBs under the legislation at this point in time?
Well, in the particular circumstance, APRA's advised that vested benefits have been breached, but minimum requisite benefits hadn't been breached, and just looking at what was going to be done, and it was closer to minimum requisite benefits than to vested benefits, so there was a danger if markets had gone down further that minimum requisite benefits would have been breached also, but so they weren't forced to act, but in that circumstance they did take a very practical approach.
I think the Actuaries Institute, or many actuaries individually at least, have found APRA reasonably good to deal with over the period in terms of being, and so no doubt they've heard many times, is it in the members' interest to close down their fund or whatever, and it's in that context that a sensible, practical situation needs to be identified, particularly where there's an employer who is actually viable in the long term and willing in the long term, but depending on what short-term situations might apply. I might just perhaps move on, because we can easily come back and most of the discussion points are there, and we can come through to that anyway. Wind-up priorities was one of the things we mentioned in our submission, because the current provisions under SIS are arguably inequitable in some circumstances, and in terms of defined benefit versus defined contribution members, or ex-employees over current employees, and I think a few actuaries have had some practical examples where, in a wind-up situation, the wisdom of Solomon isn't quite working, because the specific provisions in the SIS Act are not helpful to ensure what an actuary might think was more broad equity. That's one of the aspects of our submission that. Where we've identified that, well, if funding for defined benefits is being beefed up and there's all issues around control and defined benefits, then there are other related issues that come into play to some extent, and wind-up priorities was one of them. Again, they are in the CIS Act at present, so that's... I think it's on our agenda for discussion without... and it's been drawn to APRA's attention in the standard, so that has some issues. And, you know, I said greater flexibility would be desirable, I think, in the actuary's opinion, from an equity viewpoint, but it doesn't necessarily fit with the priority for MRBs over other benefits, where, you know, basically, obviously, an accumulation member, their entire account is their MRB. And that's 100% covered. In other cases, ex-employees typically are 100% covered, and people who become an ex-employee just prior to a company becoming insolvent or under administration are effectively advantaged relative to continuing employees at the time of that circumstance. So they're the sorts of issues. But we, again, identify that there could be transition issues, that if anything you change which advantages one group compared to another would have issues around it. DB shortfalls on insolvency was another just point that's been mentioned as an issue with APRA having their mind on at some stage. It's in the context, again, that the priorities on assets of a insolvent employer, they do change from time to time. The tax office is very close to the front of the queue. Wages obviously are up there somewhere. In more recent times, there were changes to give superannuation contributions some higher priority than previously. But from if defined benefits funds are seen in context of accumulation funds, then the issues around any shortfalls in defined benefit funds and what priority they should have by comparison with accumulation members is an issue that we raised in our submission. Some other issues that weren't necessarily in the funding section, but a couple of them certainly are. The first one was segregation of defined benefit and defined contribution assets, where there was a short sentence which identified this was an issue that was being looked at as part of the standards, and we were very concerned if that was going to require complete segregation of assets, then that had all sorts of implications, and there's quite a few points in our submission relating to that. Jeff in his query a little while ago alluded to the issues where in some cases defined benefit funds have been separated out from their accumulation members. In other cases, the accumulation members and defined members may be in one fund, but the rules may actually prohibit surplus being used from the DB section into the DC section. But in other cases, and perhaps the majority of cases, that's not the case. So where most employer-sponsored funds or sub-funds have defined benefit and accumulation interests, the loss of access to surplus might not be that big a deal, as long as it then can be used to finance DC members' contributions after the departure of the last defined benefit member or something like that. So the issue of segregating the assets of the fund in that sort of circumstance becomes extremely important if the DB is going to be looked at separately and there isn't that ability for the employer to recapture those surplus assets. Now, there's certain other cases where they can't capture them anyway because there's only defined benefit members, but I think it's very important from the institute's perspective or from the fund's perspective, for those funds where they do actually have DB and DC together, the ability to not have those assets completely separated is fairly important. And it's our expectation that full segregation of assets is not actually going to be required, just a stronger approach about ensuring things like cross-subsidy of investment returns or expenses or whatever is managed properly or equitably. There was a mention in the APRA submission about an agreed funding plan, and we weren't quite sure whether that was meant to be some quite large, grandiose statement covering all aspects of funding, or whether it was merely, if you like, the letter where the employer agrees to the latest recommended contribution rate. And our expectation it's going to be closer to the latter than the former, so that it's it's something that I think, again, the those on the committee said many of the firms appear to be getting employer commitment to agreed contributions in a sort of written format already as part of the review process. That may become a formality, I think, for all funds, which wasn't seen to be an issue from the committee's, the legacy subgroup's perspective. Treatment of sub-funds, including actuaries' responsibilities, another sort of short, brief point in APRA's draft. Some of the technical requirements, including, for example, the whistleblower provisions, actually apply at fund level, not specifically at sub-plan level. The inclusion of this sort of statement was to, whereas in practice, again, most, say, master trusts or industry funds with DB subplans are dealing with the subplan as an entity from an actuarial perspective. This is more just clarifying that, you know, all of the provisions around actuarial supervision need to be effectively applied at a subplan level rather than a total trust level. As we were aware, there are special requirements present for annual funding assessments of plans paying pensions and the high probability statements, which are sort of still being required. It was identified that that was another issue, we didn't have any specific recommendation on what needed to happen with that. Return of surplus provisions I touched on briefly before about where we did include a proposal that specifying certain levels of overfunding which could allow easy access to the withdrawal of surplus, I suppose, and other provisions, as was discussed, about potentially contingent assets or other assets outside the fund which might be able to be used in the funding assessment statements. Now, other than identifying that they're issues that could or should be addressed in terms of the funding plan, there's some of those things that were in our statement. The self-insurance, it's part of this Prudential Centre announcement was that self-insurance would be restricted to DB funds or sub-funds that currently self-insure and with actuarial certification of adequacy. We didn't get into, in our particular funding area, a lot around the insurance side, but another part of the Institute's submission certainly went into some detail on the ramifications of the self-insurance provisions and the withdrawal of those provisions for defined contribution funds or others should be treated very carefully in, again, from a member's interest, member equity perspective, there's lots of implications around insurance in a lot of areas which what might be nice from an apparent ease of simplicity and security approach has negative implications as far as many members are concerned in terms of them actually getting cover, which they would otherwise have. There's quite a bit in our submission around that. Again, not in the funding area, but under one of the governance provisions, there's requirements present for trustees to satisfy a fit and proper purpose and the intention to expand that to responsible management in a somewhat wider frame than is currently the case, and that is going to include actuaries and auditors as effectively being responsible persons as far as the fund is concerned, and therefore subject to fit and proper provisions, including things like police checks and bankruptcy and that sort of thing, which does have implications for individual actuaries and auditors in that process. Again, the Institute mentioned that in its submission. And that's pretty much it in terms of what I wanted to specifically identify. There's lots of little dot points in there which we'd very much welcome input from people on whether they've got issues in those specific areas and that we need to... We'd like to be aware of where members are having issues that... lots of us are handling lots of different funds and there's lots of different issues in lots of places, and it's something that those on the committee don't necessarily see a lot of, and so where members have individual circumstances, we're very keen to get feedback.
any areas in particular, Mike, or just anything on the last page sort of thing?
Was the funding and solving certificates and practicalities was the one where we know that lots of that there are lots of issues that, you know, almost every fund could have its own individual quirk in some way, shape or form. So that's one area. As far as the later points are concerned, on the segregation, we were initially concerned, but subsequent discussions with APRA have indicated that we probably had read more into that than was intended. And again, the funding plan, it's really just a broad agreement of the employer to an approach so that the trustee and the employer and the actuary are all on the same page, effectively, of where that's going. And so that the fitness and propriety will require the trustee of a defined benefit fund to make an annual assessment of the fitness and propriety of their appointed actuary.
Clearly no one's concerned about that requirement. Very comfortable.
As long as my investments don't make me go bankrupt. Yeah.
What about, there's not really much focus here, I mean, of those. There's a big focus in the submission on self-insurance, which isn't, as Mike says, one of the areas he was keenly interested in, but has anybody had any concerns about the that self-insurance is basically something that's not favoured by APRA and is trying to remove it as much as possible, other than grandfathering it for existing arrangements? I think I remember when I read the Prudential Standardised Tax, it still wasn't clear exactly what would be the case for basically the difference between a defined benefit member or a defined benefit fund, and is it being maintained in relation to defined benefit members of defined benefit funds or defined benefit funds, which of course would include accumulation members. So was it at the fund level or at the member level that self-insurance was going to be allowed to continue or not?
And I'm not certain that we know, actually, in that respect.
Understanding intentions at the member level, not at the fund level. Okay, so that points to, I guess, some of the important parts that Mike mentioned, and we hope that there will be some, I guess, flexibility, discretion in unwinding arrangements, because it may not be possible to replicate some, I guess, of the more unusual sorts of insurance arrangements if there are some with an insured arrangement, certainly straight away, and that if we move too quickly, then members could end up being worse off than at least having some self-insurance is better than having guaranteed no actual insurance.
Yeah, that's occupational issues, health evidence, individual health evidence areas are two that very quickly come to mind.
Yep.
Even definitions of TPD that are uninsurable is another one.
Yep.
Yes, Jeff. A microphone nearby.
I just had a comment on the pension issue there. I think if we think vested benefits are the minimum that the member is entitled to on, say, wind-up, then for a person who has a pension in the course of payment, that benefit must be related to the market value of that pension, and we should be deferring back to annuity values and a basis that is a lot more aligned to annuity values. These people, if the funds are wound up, they are not getting their vested benefit. I think that then translates down into members who potentially have a pension benefit, that we should be funding it a lot more strongly than our annual valuation and our high probability check, which we can all tick off, and that's terribly insufficient.
You're talking about real pensioners in a real fund, as distinct from the majority of pension funds, which are one-man SMSFs.
That's right. And if we're talking about vested benefits, we can only be talking about giving them something they can go back into the market and replace the benefit.
I'm not close to the annuity market, but I understood it perhaps doesn't exist in terms of can you actually get a proper market price on a lifetime?
It does exist. There are two providers at least. They price differently, but I've tried this and the differences are very large.
And where I think the pension liability on an individual fund is significant, then that's something that the actuary should certainly be taking into account.
I think it's more than that. I think when we're certifying investor benefits, we should be using that for any pension benefit that's in there.
Michael Bergen. Sorry, Jeff, but I think what I've seen in the UK market is that moving to more stringent funding requirements has resulted essentially in the biggest drop-off of pension provision that any country has ever suffered without being on the losing end of a major military conflict. And so I think we're pretty concerned that if the requirements were to go as far as one would want them to be in an ideal world, and especially if they were to do so without ease of access to services, then one could find that the disadvantages of the stronger protection of benefits would land up far outweighing the advantages and not getting the intended overall result.
Yes, I think that's a very good point, and it does come back to what's in the interest of members in terms of a highly funded poor benefit or a not quite so well funded more generous benefit. What would the member rather have, I guess? And the short answer is, as long as they retire before we get found out on the on a not so generous funding, they would always prefer the higher benefit. But and that's where the employer covenant type issue and the ability for the employers to be certain or give comfort that the funding is actually there is potentially an important mechanism if you can't have the alternative, which is easy access to the surplus. Now, trustee provisions are one, but I think the more practical problem at present is that under the CIS rules, any repatriation of surplus has to go through a certain process, and the practicalities of that process are that the employer can't have 100% of the surplus that's there. And again, in our submission, we identified potentially access to surplus on one, and one leg was total service accrued liabilities being more than funded. Another leg was the additional funding contributions that are required according to a funding plan because it's in unsatisfactory financial position. If quarantining of those additional contributions could at least be highlighted so that if it turned out they weren't needed, then an easy refund of the whole of those was specifically available. Now, again, in our submission we said there's lots of admin difficulties around that sort of issue, but if we're moving to a new world where higher levels of funding are potentially going to be either required or strongly encouraged or the like, and the employers are stuck with the position of that they're being at risk of losing access to all of that if it turns out that those stronger levels of funding were not really required with the a bounce back of investment markets, for want of a better word, then at least the thought that under the new regime the additional funding that was being required could be quarantined in some way as being, if you like, employer money by right almost, as long as the if it is not actually needed to fund those defined benefits that it was put there for.
So, having been through a period where we actually returned services to employers back a long time ago, I'm very old, and those same funds went into deficiency. I think actuaries have to be really careful about the surplus issue, and I think it's not a criticism of the profession, but I think we've not recognised that there are market cycles, and sometimes you need to be in quite a great deal of surplus, and we've tended to recommend contribution holidays too readily and not retaining enough money within funds in recognition of the market cycle, because the number of funds who were in deficiency last time was, I think there's only one fund that wasn't, I knew that one. So I think we have to have more rigour in the way we actually deal with surpluses rather than deficiencies. It's just a general comment about how many funds have got into difficulty in the last few years, and I don't think that they should have. I don't think as a profession we should be allowing funds to get in those positions, but it's just a general comment.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that, I think the question then is, would those members be better off if there was in fact better provisions around employer access to surplus on termination, on when defined benefit members have gone? It's the as I say, I've got a fund today and it's nicely in surplus and it has 50 members in it or whatever, and we decide not to have a contribution holiday, we continue the contributions, and 50 becomes 40, becomes 30, becomes 20, and we've all seen funds like that.
No,
and then you've got this big surplus, and if it's defined benefit only, the one thing that, yeah, I mean, I've had some discussions, and as others may have well, do you want to enrol some more people in the defined benefit fund as your mechanism of not using it, not losing access to the surplus? And, you know, if that can work, then that can work, but... it's a mechanism of dealing with the difficulty of access to surplus. And I said, I agree with you in terms of repatriation of surplus whilst a fund is continuing its significant size with significant liabilities which could go down. The issue is, I think more of us is coming across, is funds which are going from thousands to hundreds, hundreds to dozens and dozens to single digits, and where there's then some surplus there. And one of the outcomes of the changes could well be a faster wind-up of some remaining defined benefit funds, and our visitor friend with a UK background has certainly identified that, and again, in my firm as well, we're getting the same information from UK background and US as well, that higher funding requirements only goes in one direction as far as members' benefits are concerned. And I think from the actuary's perspective, members having inferior benefits to what they used to have isn't the outcome that we're trying to get to.
I do agree with
that. Any more questions? Any more questions? Okay. So we might wrap it up there. So I'd like to thank everybody for their participation today. I'd like to thank Angie for asking the first question. I'll see you afterwards, I'll get your name and address. And also I'd particularly like to thank Mike for his efforts in putting together the presentation, and I'd like us to show our appreciation of Mike. Thank you.